Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome back to Close Reads here on the Close Reads Podcast Network. I'm David Kern and I'm joined by Sarah Jane Bentley and Matt Bianco. Sarah Jane, Matt, how's it going?
Very well over here. Thank you. How is it with you guys?
It's brilliant over here.
Get some nice crisp fall air. Should we banter about the weather, or I mean, is it just raining in England? What's the?
it's pretty much the same. We're the same latitude, aren't we? I mean, talking about the weather would be a very British thing to do.
Have you been walking in the? You said you were going to walk out in the rain with your sister. Did you end up doing that?
We did last week. Yes.
How was the Welsh stew?
That came off well. Did you make any?
I haven't yet because most of the ingredients I got to order online.
Sorry.
I'm sure I could find substitutes, but I am planning to make it sometime between now and Christmas. Speaking of walking out in the English weather, I feel like reading this book, most of the time when they're walking outside, they're describing walking outside in England. And I'm getting very confused because I feel like this is a very British book, but it takes place in America. And I wanted to ask you something about that in a minute, but I wanted to remind people about how they can get in touch with us. You can remember that you can send your questions in on Facebook. Just search Close Reads Discussion Group on Facebook, or you can email them to us at closereadspodcast@gmail.com. And of course you can get in touch with us on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at Close Reads Pods. Next week, we will conclude the book. We're going to talk chapters 13 through 18 today, and then we will talk the final chapters next week. And then we will do the Q&A episode. So that episode will be dedicated to your questions, things that you want us to talk about that we didn't get to, and perhaps some odds and ends that we want to get to that we didn't manage to in these last two episodes. So I guess that means that next week will be the penultimate episode, and then we'll do the finale on the Rector of Justin series.
Which makes today the anti-penultimate episode. Mm. I just wanted to
What was last week's episode then? The anti-penultimate episode? The fourth to the last?
The pre-anti.
The pre-anti, exactly. We're going to talk 13 through 18, and there are a couple specific things that I want to talk about. I'm going to hold off on the Britishness of this book question, because I want to address something that you said off the air last week, Sarah Jane. And then there are two chapters in this particular section, which I think are a little bit confounding for some people.
Prurient.
Exactly. And also, there are just questions about why they're here. There's chapter 14 with the strange scene between Brian and Cordelia. And then there is the selection from, my mind is drawing a blank, from, what's his name? Charles Strong's little book, Charlie. Yeah. His little aside, which we are told is the one chapter that they saved, and we learn that it was actually Charlie who had burnt it and not her father, but not Prescott. And Prescott kind of didn't tell her the whole truth and all that.
I don't know about you. There are times reading that I was thinking, oh, what a shame this didn't end up in the flames.
Well, that's exactly what I want to talk about, because the things that, that Auchincloss is doing with the various points of view and the different perspectives are more complicated in this section, I think, than throughout earlier parts of the book, because at least Griscom is coherent, right? At least Brian is coherent. At least old Horace is fairly coherent and at times even eloquent. But when we get inside Cordelia's head, and then when we meet her outside of her head, it's even worse. And then when we get in Charlie's head, it's relatively incoherent. So what do you think the purpose of these chapters are? Sarah Jane, I'll ask you first, because you said off the air that you were you thought that the chapter 14 was I think you might have even said poorly written. So I want to give you a chance to defend that off-air statement that you made to me last week, or maybe at least make the case for that. And then I want to talk about Charlie. And then we can get into, you know, more on Prescott that we get through Jules Griscom's perspectives. So defend the case on chapter 14 being a poorly written chapter.
14 or 13?
Well, 14 is the one with the scene with
Bunny. Come off it, Bunny.
Yeah, 13 is Cordelia's. Okay. We're still in Cordelia's story that she's telling to Brian.
But it's from the perspective of Brian.
Yeah, remembering it. And then 14 is the one where it's in Brian's journal, and it's the when she kind of tries to, you know, be Delilah.
So can I defend that Cordelia is possibly a poorly written character rather than Brian's?
Yeah, you can make that case. Sure.
I don't necessarily think that Brian's account is badly written in chapter 14. But I think the presentation of Cordelia is somewhat... I don't know. It just lacks subtlety. And fair enough, maybe that's the point. But she's reclining in pink negligee before a pitcher of martinis, in which she had obviously been imbibing prior to my arrival. And then she sits down and has supper with Brian, presumably still in her negligee. I mean, is Auchincloss not even going to let her put her clothes back on? I don't know.
That happens in America all the time. So.
Oh, just, right, okay, yeah. Fine. They are in New York, after all. I mean.
Exactly.
Yeah. It made me think a bit of some of those paintings of reclining nudes, but almost like a parody of that. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So you've got something very risque but refined, like the Venus of Urbino in the Uffizi by Titian. And then you get Manet and Degas painting these reclining nudes a bit more crudely, in a bit more of a kind of modern sort of style.
And then you got Picasso. Cordelia seemed
to me like one of those.
So, but how does that make her? I mean, so that illusion is making her too one-dimensional, not complicated enough as a character. Is that the case that you're making?
Yes, I just don't find it believable. I think that the dialogue is, as Matt picked up on, is kind of trite and unconvincing. I mean, she's an intelligent woman. We know that. She's read a lot of literature. She has viewed a lot of art. Cordelia could be more seductive than this, surely.
Although the picture of martinis might impact that.
If she was consistent though with the kind of character that she was presented as in her little flat in Paris, I don't know.
So go ahead, Matt, you're gonna say something.
Yeah, I wonder if it's reflective of her ability to adapt to the person she's with. So the way she seduces Charlie is different than the way she attempts to seduce Brian. And of course, this is all from Brian's perspective too, right? So Brian doesn't necessarily seem like the type of guy who would pick up on subtleties in a woman. So then he can't describe them if he's not picking up on them. But you're right. Like, unless he's lying, which there's no reason to believe that, he's not telling us that she wore a negligee to dinner, to supper, except because she did. And so there is this kind of, like you're saying, Sarah, I think this, Sarah Jane, there is this awkwardness to the fact that she's very crudely lying there in her negligee and then moves over to the supper table, still in her negligee, that lacks subtlety. But I wonder if she's doing that because
she thinks he's not,
she's reacting to Brian, right? She's becoming what she thinks Brian will respond to, and perhaps then what is actually her lack of nuance and subtlety is that she's always only ever somebody who's trying to shock another person.
Yes, that's really interesting, and to be a bit kinder to her, perhaps her last and longest relationship was with Turnbull, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. And through that, her interaction with a man was, we're told, very kind of, as you can tell, I'm getting embarrassed even talking about it. But there are things that happened with her and Turnbull that couldn't even be described in the novel, and that she didn't even dare repeat to her father.
That he shocked her.
Yes.
So the shocker was shocked.
she's learned this from Turnbull, and she's become hardened in a way.
One of the things that complicates it, which, and that's why I brought it up at the beginning, is I think that as we shift through all these different perspectives, the whole point of the novel is kind of about how people think about other people. So, you know, Brian's trying to understand Prescott, and he's trying to think about his own experiences with him. His journals are sort of his way of, you know, almost psychoanalyzing, to use a theme that keeps coming up, his own feelings about Prescott. But then he's also trying to learn about how other people think about Prescott. And so there's this kind of ongoing theme of the way people think about other people is often very incomplete and biased and prejudiced. And very rarely do you see the whole picture. I think even in the bit with Jules Griscom, one of the things that it's getting at in Griscom's, you know, it's from Griscom's perspective, of course, but he's basically saying Prescott in these moments is attending to certain ideals and not seeing us as individual people. There's even the bit where he talks about his own mother, and he says that his mother loved humanity, but didn't love individual people. Mm-hmm. And so I think one of the things that we're getting at here is this sense of, that the novel's getting at, is this sense of, how do you actually know a person?
Yep.
How do you know another person? And so if the book was giving us these really coherent, consistent characters from all these different perspectives, then it would just be the book knowing a person as opposed to the characters knowing a person. So while I'm not necessarily disagreeing that Cordelia, for example, is an inconsistent character, or that she's, you know, perhaps could have been more finely drawn or whatever, I think the challenge for Auchincloss is, how do you get at the complicated ways that people know each other and know themselves, while also offering us something as readers coherent enough to latch onto to make the experience of reading the book, you know, to offer it the proper amount of catharsis and resolution and all those sorts of things. The conflict can't just be in the complicated way that people know each other, but that theme underlying the novel makes our experience with it that much more complicated, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I think so. I think that possibly, though, when Auchincloss tries to introduce contrast, it's too extreme. So Matt, you were saying that Brian doesn't really understand subtlety in a woman. I'm not sure if that's true, because his first interactions with Harriet are very subtle and gentle. And he's almost in love with Harriet, because it's a cerebral connection. It's beyond how Harriet looks. And she is seen as beautiful, even though she's kind of in her twilight years. Whereas Cordelia, I suppose, it attacks his prudishness, his kind of puritanical innocence. And maybe that's why Brian is unable to respond to her in a way that's sympathetic. Perhaps. He calls her a shameless hussy.
It's interesting that he is, at least as an observation, that he is more enamored with Harriet, who, as you said, very tactfully is in the twilight of her years, as opposed to this person who's actively trying to be seductive. You know, he's kind of repulsed in a way, like he runs away. But I wonder why he doesn't run away right away. He stays long enough to have dinner with her. You know, is he trying to be polite?
Right. What's interesting too is that he's careful to point out that she's 15 years his senior. So that's which I hadn't noticed before. I hadn't thought about it, but I think you're right, Sarah Jane, that there is a kind of attachment or a love for Harriet that allows him to see the subtlety and to be sympathetic toward her. But then it's lacking with Cordelia, and with Cordelia, at the most he's willing to be is polite, but not sympathetic or subtle, or, you know, to see the subtleties or anything like that.
You know, what's been really playing in my mind is the image of the sofa. So Crébillon is the last word of Harriet, and Crébillon has written this novel about the sort of profanity of the sofa, which is this new sort of phenomenon in Parisian society where, you know, people would actually sit down next to one another in the living room and maybe women's ankles would be visible. And then again, we have this image of Cordelia pulling Brian down onto the sofa beside her. And then it's also something that Charlie talks about in his memoir. What does he say? Did you pick up on this sofa coming back again and again? And there's some tension here between the kind of decorum of the drawing room and Prescott's study, and then the more sort of profane environment of the living room or the sofa or the bedroom, that I think Auchincloss is interested in.
I did not pick up on it. So
I was just wondering why is Crebillon the last word of Harriet? Because that's, you know, it's a significant thing. It's brought up twice early in the novel.
And Prescott specifically says how very like her or something to that effect. Yeah.
I'm trying to find where it is.
And that'd be in 15, right?
I remember I do remember him, you know, Cordelia pulling him down onto the sofa beside her, but I don't remember it in the manuscript. I'm trying to find it there.
Yeah, it is there in the manuscript. I'm so sorry. I can't find it. Boring for people to listen to. in a side note, there is a sense that Cordelia, shall I say, preys on innocent men. So Charlie and Brian are quite an interesting parallel in that sense. And there's actually another reference to Macbeth where Charlie says there's no bottom. Charlie has no bottom to his voluptuousness. Nay, your wives, your daughters, your matrons and your maids could not fill up the cistern of my lust. And that's what Malcolm says when he's bluffing to Macduff, pretending that he has all these vices that he doesn't actually have. So there is a sense in which Cordelia is capable of bringing out the, I don't know what it is, what would Freud say, some kind of Freudian subconscious sexual libido, and that Cordelia is the person who will bring that out in the men. And so Charlie and Brian are quite similar in that sense.
Well, I was thinking a lot about how there's this running theme throughout the book of how Prescott is always trying to keep the boys from being in situations where they'd be tempted. And then everyone assumes that it's some sort of, then everyone's bringing up all these Freudian questions, right? The younger Griscom even accuses his, says, I don't know enough about Freud to know what I'm talking about, but he probably had some sort of, you know, affection for, he's talking about his father for, like attraction for Prescott. And my favorite thing is when these characters say, I don't actually know anything about Freud, but these progressive ideas must be right. And so they must apply somehow.
Yeah.
But there's always this question of Frank trying to always sort of protect people's purity, keep them out of temptation, things like that. And then his daughter being the one that sort of, you know, seduces or tries to, you know, corrupt these men who he has taken under his wing, whether it's Charlie or Brian or even her husband Turnbull, who really likes Prescott, and they become friends. And so she's kind of always, her sort of romantic life, putting it generously, is sort of always at odds with the ideals and goals of her father and the whole mission of the school. And that seems like that's her, you know, we talk about how her mother says, they never were able to shock me.
Yeah.
And her attempt to shock seems to be to do the opposite, to reverse the work that her father is trying to do in the only way that she knows how, to corrupt them. You know, he is trying to preserve something by attending to their spiritual life. Mm. And so there is something sort of, I guess, you know, Freudian about it, where she turns to the ideas of Freud essentially and tries to use them to corrupt the work that he's trying to do, or to preserve in them.
She, I was wondering too, as you were talking, Sarah Jane, if it was not just corrupting these innocent men, but corrupting innocent men attached to her father.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But it's not, right? Like the Catholic that she marries first,
That's a rejection of her father in a sense,
then,
though.
Yeah, and then Guy Turnbull doesn't meet her father till afterward. But then she's frustrated that her father accepts Guy Turnbull into his, you know, confidences or whatever, even after her relationship with him is over, with Guy's, right? After their marriage is over and they separated, that Guy and her father still have a friendship. That the sofa passes on 228. I found it.
228. That's right. Yes. The Couvre-Pied had fled with democracy. I wonder if it's something about an older genteel way of being, a kind of decorum, a kind of elegance of manners that has been lost or swept away by World War One, the change in culture. And it all seems to revolve around this image of the sofa and the woman reclining on the chaise longue.
So are we to read Prescott then, at least in the mind of these various characters, as sort of being a agent of preservation of that, those manners, you know, pre-World War One manners? Is that,
yeah.
Does that seem to be his, you know, reason for being this and the purpose behind the school?
Frank Prescott's?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. What did I say?
I don't know what you said, but I heard Louis Auchincloss.
Oh. Yeah, so I guess that's what
maybe
I mean.
Maybe also Auchincloss. There's a kind of nostalgia.
Yeah, I mean, so, and I guess then if that's the case, then the follow-up question is the assumption that it's pure nostalgia or that there is meant to be something inherently better about those manners, that way of, that you're talking about, that way of life that you're talking about, Sarah Jane.
Yeah. I don't know if you had a chance to look again at the preface, I think, to Norms and Nobility, where David Hicks talks about the onset of democracy, specifically at Justin Martyr, as this this negative, having a negative impact on these kinds of values.
I don't remember. I can go run and grab it.
I was just thinking the same thing. I've got my eye on it. It's on my bookcase. Just to...
Well, we...
And that the school is trying to prevail against the modern ideas of democracy.
Well,
where the people are God.
The
demos is the people.
I mean, this is kind of one of the American questions. Like, what are we costing ourselves by valuing democracy? And what does democracy enable? That's an English question too.
Yeah. Eva Brand has a book called The Paradox of Education in a Republic. That's about the founding of America and then the establishment of education, and talking about how you have to educate a people who are bold enough to revolt against their oppressors when needed, but submissive enough to, you know, maintain the republic as it's, you know, as it is. And just the paradox of trying to educate two different kinds of people. Mm. But perhaps something of that, right? Like he's trying to create men who are manly enough to, you know, fit this kind of stereotype, or this image, this type that he has for them.
Who are capable of feats of strength.
Yeah. But then not so reckless in their manliness that they throw off him or God or religion or
virtue
or these kinds of principles that we ought to live by. And Brian is, of course, doesn't fit his image of what it means to be a man, at least at the beginning. But here is the one who can stand up to Cordelia.
And then there's Charlie as an interesting sort of model of a student who goes through there, who is physically capable, like talks about his physical prowess, right? Mm-hmm. And who goes off and, you know, fights in the war and is kind of ruined by it. What is able to withstand what that he's been given through Justin Martyr is able to withstand what he goes through in the war.
It's such a central question in the novel, isn't it? What makes a man? I think especially in this section, it comes up several times explicitly. And that, as you've already said a little bit, that Cordelia is trying to shock her father by winning some sort of competition. She says, "I certainly was in competition with Pa. My two men were men, after all." So she takes his best prefect, and then she takes the businessman, who is a kind of a bit of a fascination for Prescott, because if we remember, Prescott had always had this interest in business and the world of profit, although he didn't give into it. And then again, she says on page 216, "Give me Beethoven, at least he was a man." And this question comes up again and again. So the novel, in a way, is a quest for what is the real male, and is Justin Martyr? Is it producing them? Is it cultivating the real man?
Yeah, in Norms and Nobility, kind of the two questions that ride through it from one end to the other. But Hicks basically states is two questions that have to be answered with respect to education. When you're educating, you have to answer the question, what is God and what are the purposes of man?
Yes, you need an anthropology, yeah.
Yeah, and then that seems now what's happening here, right? So, you know, I mean, in the earlier episodes, we kept focusing on and noticing these questions surrounding what is God and to what extent is Frank God, or is Frank synonymous with God at least? And now we're starting to see a development of the, or an emphasis, or it's coming out in our conversation anyway, the emphasis on the what is man part, what are the purposes of man, what does it mean to be a man aspect of it.
What do you think of the idea that for all of the materialists in the novel who Frank encounters, because they are unable to conceive of something immaterial, rather than seeing God reflected in Frank, they see God or Frank as God, which is a mistake. And as you were arguing last week, there is a true Prescott who the reader can know, which is ultimately through Brian. And Brian is able to see God reflected in Frank. And he repeats that several times when he's discussing Charlie's manuscript. Whereas materialists are not able to see that because there's no, you know, hope for what is unseen. It's only the seen world that exists for them. I wonder if Auchincloss is challenging that idea.
Yeah. That makes a lot of sense to me. That's perhaps what's happening there. Because you see the explicit comments on a person being a materialist or on materialists. But then even the way you see them and those characters interact with Frank, right? Like Griscom trying to create Frank in this image that he has for what he ought to be.
Yeah. That's right. And so this is where the confusion comes, perhaps, for the other characters, which perhaps Auchincloss is quite skillful at showing, and that the reader has to somehow navigate through that to see the difference between faith and idolatry. The question about
idolatry that's sort of bound up in resentment, it's still fundamentally a sort of idolatry.
Is it what are the two heresies, as it were, being represented by Griscom and Cordelia, right? Because Griscom is
which Griscom, older or younger?
Older Griscom. Good question. Yeah, older Griscom is trying to it's almost like he's saying Frank is God, and this is how I want him to be seen and represented and pictured. Mm-hmm. And then Cordelia's is if my father's God, he's imperfect, he's broken, it's more emphasis on the human side than the divine side, as it were.
Which brings us to the conversation that young Griscom has with Frank in the classroom about polytheism. And they're talking about, Frank's telling him if there's polytheism, you know, that's why people saw the world as sort of a dark place, because they were just competing with each other. Mm-hmm. And it's as if she kind of views him as like a pagan god, like a sort of Zeus figure. Mm-hmm. Whereas Griscom sort of views him as a, I don't, you know, we can, you said heresy. We can, you know, I don't know what the comparison exactly is, you know.
I think he sees him as a kind of demigod. And if Griscom had half a chance, he would erect a bronze statue of Prescott and kind of encourage people to bow down to it. And it was, as Sylvester said, that Prescott, you know, oh yeah, well, he can be whatever you want him to be. It's just great to have a role model. doesn't really matter what exactly he stood for. We've forgotten all that now.
So there's obviously a place for role models, icons of good things, so to speak, in yes. our lives, particularly in education. So is it that Griscom has taken that too far? Like, he doesn't have a balance for it. He doesn't recognize that Frank Prescott is sort of an icon for a certain set of virtues, but he's still human. And then Cordelia doesn't recognize that he can be an icon or sort of representative of certain kinds of virtues. And so she sort of is only consumed with his sort of human complicated nature, as I suppose sometimes happens with parents, right? But then is Brian's meant to be sort of the character in the middle that sort of balances that out, balances out those two perspectives?
Griscom thinks that paradise is here on this earth, so he can't see beyond, I think is the problem. Whereas Prescott is always teaching to look beyond. He says at one point in this section, there's no difference between the pulpit and the schoolroom. He says, I tried to put a bit of God into everything, which is, you know, as if he wasn't already there. And whereas Cordelia, I think, has bought into some Freudian idea that we're all just a product of our desires, and our desires are some sort of chemical reaction. But, I mean, that's a kind of gross oversimplification of Freudian theory, but that seems to be what Cordelia is about. She's about getting power and manipulating people emotionally.
And Brian says of that the war is hardly worth winning if our boys are going to have to come home to women like her.
I know, that is brutal. But it's sad for Cordelia because she sees her father then as cold and hard and distant because he doesn't succumb to her emotional manipulation.
Mm. Yeah, and there's all these great scenes that remind me in some ways of Brideshead, where she's trying to manipulate him and he just looks at her and he gives her a wink and it kind of changes the whole tone of the scene. And
he once does.
I think he gives up and walks away and he
forgives.
Yeah, yeah. He is very consistent even in his own manipulation, so to speak. Like when he kind of controls the thing about burning the book, or he makes her come home, and every day he has these certain habits of these sort of like formal ways of interacting with her. He has breakfast every day with her, but he has certain expectations of her, but he's not going to let her control him. And it's like those fits of formal interaction, such as at breakfast, are how he engages with her, but keeps her at arm's length. He sort of controls their relationship in a way that probably she needs, but also he knows he will allow him to maintain the controlling peace that he needs, I think.
He says children don't need to be loved. They need devotion, right? Mm. So is that what he means? Is that what it means to be devoted rather than love?
He does seem devoted to her.
That's right. And that
even in her indiscretions.
Love and faith are a matter of actions. He says that at one point as well, that faith is something that is not really about contemplation. He seems to think it's about virtuous action.
Embodiment.
Yeah, that's what he says at one point.
Which is why then it would make sense that he is consumed with sort of physical prowess, because you have the stronger you are, the more capable you are of taking right action, of embodying faith and love. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. And also why he has this great regret that he never fought in a war. And he confesses it to Charlie. That we spoke a little bit about courage last week, I think. That Charlie has fought in a war. And Prescott is almost envious of this because he would have liked the opportunity to demonstrate what he could have done. But Charlie sort of says, you know, you don't need to. And Prescott is often compared to generals. It happens again on page 230, where Charlie describes him as A general, he says, I see myself as an aide-de-camp standing on a hilltop over the battle, absorbed in my general's tactics and mindless of the shells and bullets over my head. So the leadership that Prescott provides is...
This is his time as a... Or he calls himself the rector's hound, right? What was he?
Yeah.
A prefect or something?
That's right. He's the sort of the head boy or the head prefect. And I got interested in this bit, in the sermon, and how it relates to his relationship with Charlie, what Prescott expects of his prefects. So he gives a sermon, doesn't he, on the laborers in the vineyard when he comes back to Justin Martyr as the emeritus professor.
Oh, yeah, in Brian's journal. Yeah, that's in 16 or something.
And
235, right?
Yeah.
234, 235.
And so I wondered what you thought about the significance of that. Why that sermon? Why that parable? Because he seems to be almost using that sermon to uphold everything he believes about a life of service and altruism, serving the community.
It says too that the note of levity fell away. A pucker appeared in his brow and the tone deepened. So, you know, if he, you know, we're meant to take this moment seriously, certainly.
I think he's preaching to himself.
I agree.
I think he's saying, I'm the day long laborer. And then what's the guy's name that's taken his place?
Duncan Moore, is it?
Moore, yeah. Dr. Moore is a late minute, last minute, you know, guy that shows up. But in the Lord's eyes, that they're both, you know, equal the same. They both earn the same rewards, right? And Frank's talking to himself, yeah, like, stop being such a baby about this, right? Mm-hmm. This is, Duncan's doing good, is doing the work.
Because then the very next scene, he
takes it all. But yeah, he, well, then you see, in the very next scene, you see why he needed to preach that sermon to himself, right? Yeah. Because he doesn't feel it. But then when he says to Brian later, he says, when he says, don't come back to visit me anymore, on page 241, he says, I'm put off by the merest trifles. I can still see that they're trifles, but the time may be coming when I won't. I want you to remember me as I was. So it's like, I mean, that's sometime later from the first instance, I guess, but he knows he's being kind of childish about it.
So is his, go ahead, yeah, answer again.
Well, he seems to contradict himself there, because earlier he said, you know, you're trying to bury me under my own reputation. And now he seems to be quite happy to be buried by it.
Yeah.
So is this sending away, when he sends Brian away, the same as when he sends the elder Griscom away, where he says, you don't need me. Brian says, you don't need me. And he says, no, you don't. And then earlier, David Griscom is saying, I want to stay here and teach. And he says, no, you have to go away because you can't teach. You need teacher because it's your calling to teach, not because you need to feel safe here. Yeah. So I was wondering, is the same thing happening here? Is it sort of like in the Narnia books where Aslan tells them, you know, they say, we want to stay. And he says, no, it's not your time to stay. Is it something like that, where he's sort of challenging them and, you know.
Is he saying here, go away and don't come back, like not even to teach later on? Because at one point he says that he sees Brian as a teacher there someday. Mm-hmm. But then is here, he taking that away from him and saying, no, don't come back here to teach. I don't know if
or is he saying remember. Don't,
or just don't come back while I'm alive.
Or don't come back and see me, because he's not at the school.
Is it perhaps to do with
what
Prescott sees as the need for Brian to put down roots and establish himself and gain his confidence? Prescott says, my personality is too powerful.
Yeah.
And what Prescott doesn't want, the mistake that people keep making in the novel, is they worship Prescott. And that's not what Prescott's about. He's sort of trying to point to something beyond himself. And he's really encouraged Brian to go and do his theology degree and to become ordained. And he would like to see Brian develop the confidence to be a minister on his own merit and not dependent on Prescott. Not living in his shadow.
Yeah.
But perhaps Prescott is aware of his own ability to limit limit those who he teaches. There was a great quotation, I wish I had it in front of me, from David Hicks again, his translation of Marcus Aurelius's sort of proverbs about how the authority of a teacher can somehow limit the development of the student, which I thought worked well in terms of the relationship between Brian and Frank.
That's the question that I think I have of Frank that just keeps kind of rolling around in my head at this point. Like, okay, so with respect to Cordelia, I think you could ask this of any character, of all the characters, the boys, the students, the teachers, Griscom, is Frank simply kind of a sovereign over all of the lives that he interacts with, over the school, over the community, in a way that they all have their will, their free will to act and do as they choose, but he's kind of, all things are working together for good to those that love Frank, kind of thing. Or is he actually much more controlling and manipulative to where they're losing their will, they're losing their sense of individual personality, individual person, and they're, and everything's just doing, everybody is just having to do what Frank wants. Even in their rebellion, they're doing what Frank wants. I mean, as it were, not really, but
it seems like responding to him.
Yeah.
It seems like one of the big questions that the novel is asking and that Frank is asking in the school is, how do you balance those two things? How do you balance sort of discipline in service of pursuit of, in the service of pursuit of virtue, so to speak, with cultivating the individuality of specific people? And that and again, the question of individuality keeps coming up in all these different perspectives, and all these characters who are trying to know themselves and then figure out what that means for them. But also, you know, they're either going to, so many characters are either choosing themselves at the cost of the virtues that Frank is pursuing, or they're following his will until they, as you put it, until they sort of don't feel like they're themselves anymore. They kind of lose themselves.
Yeah. Well, it's like if you took the prodigal son story, right? Is, you know, is there one character that's like that older brother that's just always there, always feeling like, you know, he's doing exactly what the father wants?
Ives.
And yeah. and then feels unappreciated for it, which I don't think would be Ives, maybe. And then there's the younger brother who's, you know, just give me my stuff, I'm going to go and I'm going to live my own life. And then they come back when they see to it, when they come to themselves, as it says in the prodigal son story.
You know, which is more like Charlie, maybe.
Yeah.
In some ways. But Charlie comes back.
I guess is Frank being oppressively controlling? Is Frank being perfectly free, letting them be perfectly free in ways that's appropriate to who they are and to himself and, right, yeah, human nature? And then, or is he himself actually struggling with, I've been overbearing here and not bearing enough here? And
I mean, it seems to me like one of the questions is there that fine line between those two things? Can that even exist? Like, can you be after the sort of thing that Frank is after? Can that be your mission, your vocation, whatever you want to say, and still allow for the pursuit of individuality, I guess. I mean, it goes, and even there, there's the question of democracy sort of comes up, right? Like, if democracy is about, you know, the voice of the individual, then can you pursue the individual good and also pursue the sort of collective good at the same time? Do they ever go together?
Yeah.
Seems to be one of the big questions.
Does that also bring us back to the parable in the sermon? Because it's really about equity and about a conception of equity that doesn't sit comfortably in an environment where hard work and effort and striving is being taught as virtuous. So the laborers in the vineyard, at whatever point they turn up, they still are going to enjoy the same reward. And it's followed immediately by Frank being really upset about the fact that the boys won't queue up to go into the dining hall anymore. Sorry, they won't make a line.
No, we know queue.
Okay. And he says
the word, you know, we should be using more.
It shouldn't matter. They should wait their turn, and whether they're in there first or last, they're going to get the same reward. And then he actually chastises himself on page 239 for being guilty of this inability to practice the equity that he preaches, because he says, you know, he loved Charlie more than his other prefect, whose name I forget, because Charlie had charm and the other chap didn't. And he really chastises himself for being so unequal with his affections.
Yes, when he's comparing him to Martin Day, who has just died in the war.
Martin Day, that's right. Because Martin Day didn't try to earn his affections through charm, whereas Charlie did. And so he's sort of preaching a kind of equity that he struggles to meet himself. And that must be a really difficult thing for headmasters, that they do have to set themselves up as paragons of virtue. And then the dangers are either that they fail in meeting their own standards, or, as you said, people want to become clones of them rather than wanting to imbue and practice the virtues that are being extolled. And that's such a difficult boundary to negotiate. I'm really fascinated by headmasters. I think it must be one of the most difficult jobs in the world.
it's not dissimilar, though, for the teacher in the classroom, right? Like, don't we struggle with...
Or a parent,
right? Struggling with the students who have charm and those who don't. And
or your own personality. Like the positives and negatives of your own personality become... You know, because you can't let your more negative instincts as a teacher rule the room, but you also can't like let the kids who you love the most rule the room, or that are easiest to interact with.
And this is where Gnosticism is interesting in the novel as well. That Frank cannot present himself as unknowable, because that would be very damaging to his pupils. So he can't cultivate that kind of distant aloofness of a sort of unknowable God. He has to have a paternal relationship with his students so that they can actually get to know him and learn virtues in that way from him.
So do you think that is why he conducts his classrooms the way he does? The reason that he lets characters like... Jules Griscom, for example, sort of push back against him. You know, he has these dialogues about theology, like church history and things like that, and he lets them contend with him.
Yeah,
and at a certain point, he does shut it down after a while. But is he doing that out of some sort of like, is it because of what you're saying there? Is it some sort of pedagogical principle he believes in?
I think so. And it's the same pedagogical principle that means that back in the first chapters, I think it's page 41, Prescott goes around the school and checks every single part of the campus, right from the football field to the lavatories, in that order. That he hasn't set this thing, this Justin Martyr, in motion and wound up the clock and disappeared. But he's present and he's involved in his creation.
Which is why it must be so difficult for him when it's no longer something that he has, you know, the authority to review. I guess this brings us to, you mentioned a second ago, that he has his own flaws. And I guess that brings us to Jules Griscom, which we should probably discuss before we at least discuss the first few sections here.
Yeah.
We know that he ultimately dies. We've known that for a while, and that he considers Jules his greatest failure. And so we get this scene, this sort of sequence of scenes anyway, where Jules arrives at the school late, having already known who Frank Prescott is, having the legend of Prescott sort of hanging over him, being afraid might be the word for it. And then when he gets there, he distances himself, and he then ultimately runs into trouble and then is inevitably kicked out. And in those moments, Prescott seems the most like some of the, you know, Dickensian characters who run orphanages or something. when he seems the most like that. And yeah, from the outside, we can say, okay, well, I guess there's a great debate. We could have the debate. Does he handle Jules the way that, in an appropriate way? Is he justified to act towards Jules the way that he does? Maybe that's the only conversation we need to have to get deep into this tough part of the book.
It's probably the one we want to have, but I think that we need to go back one step earlier to the very first thing Jules tells us in his memoir. And I think it's telling that, and perhaps he notices this about himself, maybe not, but we know that Griscom felt the need, the elder Griscom felt the need to redeem his father's name, right? His father was bad businessman or whatever, bad guy, right? And so there's this desire, this attempt to redeem the Griscom name.
Prescott even sets him to do that. Says, yeah, you need to go redeem your family's reputation.
Right. And then Jules tells us right at the beginning of his memoir, or this section of the memoir, that in 17, chapter 17, he knows that he was named Jules after his grandfather as the final act of redeeming the grandfather. Or redeeming the name, right? Like I'm going to even, like, as if Elder Griscom is basically saying, I'm going to even make the name Jules a better name than what, you know, than the reputation it currently has. And I think that you get from Jules the younger, the image that he resents that. He resents being used that way. And so now, so he has this personality. It's that personality, the personality of a young boy who's resentful of being named and used in that way, who's now going to live with Frank Prescott.
And his response is to go into retreat. And I think ultimately, Jules' enmity with Prescott is a kind of religious one or a philosophical one, where Jules is essentially the archetype of the transcendentalist, like Thoreau, who wants to disappear off into the woods like Walden and be introspective and get away from other people. And his idea of hell is, you know, organized fun and group activity, which is the opposite of Prescott, who's preaching service, altruism, serving the community, serving one another, being part of a team, acknowledging the sort of ubiquitous impact of original sin, that we're all culpable, and they clash. And I don't think there can be any reconciliation between Jules and Prescott. And I think Prescott's great tragedy in a way is that he knows that Jules was right. He was unable to force any kind of redemption on Jules. And ultimately Jules is smashed up against a rock, appropriately. Because in the classroom, remember, Jules says, he couldn't make faith in Jesus Christ compulsory. It could only be a hope. And that's like the thing that Jules has got over Prescott.
Goes back to the question of free will that Matt was talking about.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I was at an education conference in Spain a couple of weeks ago at the University of Navarra, and Scott Kreider, who's a professor at University of Dallas, he wrote a book called The Office of Assertion that we use in some of our training. And he gave a talk on the Phaedrus. And at one point during the talk, or in questions afterward, he said, the question of can virtue be taught came up. And he said that there is no way for a teacher to guarantee that the thing he teaches will be adopted by the students and enacted by the students. And then he said, and thank God.
Yeah, that you can only show them.
And it never occurred to me that in trying to answer the question, can virtue be taught, and is there a way to teach virtue that would stick, that would also mean that then there would be a way to teach vice and slavery in a way that would stick. So there have to be failures, right? Because no matter how good Frank is, if Frank doesn't have failures, yeah, then Frank has created a way for the most evil of men to be perfectly successful at teaching his ways.
Right? And it would also go against the idea that human beings are not. So if we believe that the human being is ultimately good and completely free of sin in their nature, then education can save the world, because all you need to do is teach someone the right thing to do, and then they'll always choose that. But we know that's not what human nature is like. We just have to look at history. That people will know the right thing to do, and they will have been taught it, and they'll still choose something else. So you're right, that would be a kind of dangerous idea. And it's a very modern idea of education, I think, that it can save the world. And it's not education that can save the world.
Yeah, my dad hates when people talk about saving the world.
Yeah.
Changing the world.
Or conceiving of the human being as ultimately good and always able to make the right choice if they only know what that is.
Theoretically, though, is this a limitation in the teacher or in the nature of pedagogy? So could a perfect person like pass on virtue? Is it so? I mean, in other words, no matter how hard Frank tries to be virtuous himself, is he always going to fail? Not because it's his problem, but because of the problem of human nature and a problem with pedagogy, or is it because it's a problem with himself? So is there the distinction even worth asking about?
Well, I mean, it's much quoted, but if we think Pontius Pilate asks Jesus what is truth and then doesn't stay for an answer, I think that's kind of the answer to that question.
I guess if we're going to stay on Jesus, there's always Judas.
Yeah. Right. Or God, and there's Adam and Eve. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I mean, there's a perfect situation with a perfect teacher and a perfectly loving father who lost his children.
So the flaw is neither in the pedagogy nor the teacher, although it might be.
Right.
But it's with the student, that the student doesn't have the ears to hear things.
The eyes to see. I think that's true.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Not, I mean, always. Let's hypothetically speaking.
Right. I think what the picture of Adam and Eve shows
theoretically,
is
that, I guess, would be more
is that it's, no matter how perfect the teacher and the pedagogy, the students are still capable of failing. But then also we can see that the pedagogy can fail and the teacher can fail. Mm-hmm. So we can't pick just one and blame them. They're all three are always possible of being the fault.
So does
This is why I think that Prescott is so emphatic about Jules' story, his greatest failure, being included in his kind of this biography of a saint that Brian is writing, because Prescott is saying, look, I am not God. I am not perfect. I don't want you to write a kind of gospel, the gospel according to, you know, Frank Prescott. I'm a human being. And I have flaws, and people forget that about him.
So does Prescott then fail Jules Griscom in these scenes? I mean, do you think he acts unjustly towards him? Does his interactions with him and the way that he deals with him fail him and keep him from being what Prescott hopes he will be?
In what we've seen so far?
Yeah, I mean, we've read the two chapters. Yeah,
I think so. But I mean, I don't know, because it's possible that when we get to the rest of the memoirs, I don't know how many more chapters there are of it, just one, maybe two, that we might find that the kind of man Jules has turned out to be is actually the kind of man that Frank wanted, you know? Like, I think that happens sometimes, right? Like in those letters that he received at the beginning of the book, that it was, people are saying, I finally cast you off from me, and I'm willing to be my own man. But yeah, but that's exactly what Frank wanted you to be, was somebody who wasn't dependent on him and could be his own man, right? As we see in his final instructions to Brian, right? Separate yourself from me and be your own man. I mean, they're like those people think that Frank failed, but he actually succeeded. I don't know if there's going to be a sense of that with Jules or not. I mean, definitely right now there's not. I don't know. I sympathize with Jules. I think that Frank pushed too far.
With the destruction of the sort of idyllic romantic huts in the countryside alongside the river.
Yes. And the expulsion of the friends. Yeah.
I think the first thing really was in a way more significant, because that's where the clash of their beliefs or their philosophies comes. And after that, what Jules does is kind of a bit puerile and a bit of a reaction, isn't it? Because what Prescott is saying is, no, you're not going to be an introspective transcendentalist. You're not disappearing off into the woods on your own. You're going to stay here and be part of this community. And then, of course, it's highly appropriate that what Jules does is he locks Frank into his study and isolates him,
yeah,
and prevents him from coming into the community of the chapel. And so it's a good, very appropriate revenge that he takes.
Yeah. I was thinking how it's got a sort of, Prescott is sort of keeping Jules from pursuing his inner Thoreau.
Yeah.
And given that they're living in the Boston as well, Walden Pond was probably, yeah, you know, 30 miles from where they are.
But he also shows, not necessarily Jules, but Jules' friends, that they want the larger society, the larger community. Right, because they're the most hurt by having lost it when they can't graduate from Justin Martyr, they can't go to Harvard.
So which the larger community. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, which is the larger community that they're being disconnected from, which they thought they wanted to be disconnected from by attaching themselves to Jules.
Which is the original argument that Prescott has with Jules in his study about the destruction of the huts, about original sin and about how we're all tainted with it. So it's entirely appropriate that for isolating Prescott, Jules's punishment is that all his friends are also sent down or expelled, because he's being shown that there are public consequences to private actions, and you can't exist as this kind of this man who is an island. It's not true is what Prescott is trying to show him. And he won't compromise.
The little bit about how Ives is always watching, that there's always someone seeing you do what you think no one's seeing you do, is kind of funny, but also I think kind of genius in exploring what you're talking about there, that nothing is truly just private, that there are public consequences. I think I think that's also a theme in the Cordelia chapters as well.
Yeah. But as you're saying, thanks to Ives, nothing's ever private because Ives always sees it.
I was thinking there cannot be an accident that the word Ives sounds pretty close to eyes, and also that ivy just grows everywhere.
Yeah. Hmm.
Like it's kind of like a weed it's everywhere. It takes over everything. And in some ways it's kind of beautiful and makes things work. But then at the same time, it's like it kind of overcomes everything. It, I don't want to say poison, but it's, you know, it's sort of ubiquitous.
Pervasive.
Pervasive. Yeah. That's the word. Yeah.
Hmm. There's another sort of tit for tat with Jules and Prescott as well, where at the end of chapter 17, Jules's poem, Rejected by the Justinian, is published in Vanity Fair.
Of all places.
Yeah, and Vanity Fair, it's a reference to Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, and it's the city of kind of idle pleasures. So his work of art is rejected by, you know, Justin Martyr, which maybe is some kind of celestial city or something, and it's taken up in the alternative world. And this is a kind of triumph for Jules.
I love how you can kind of read what he says, what he says to Griscom in so many different ways. Like he says, "You've put us on the map, Griscom. There may be a question in some minds if that is where we wish to be, but nobody can belittle the feat of us getting there." You know, and you could read there with a certain kind of emphasis, as if to say the "there" being Vanity Fair in particular, not the map, but being in Vanity Fair, being in the, what, how did you put it? What, the city of pleasure or whatever?
Yeah. It's the city of idle pleasures. Yeah.
Yeah. And so, you know, he it's not that he doesn't love the idea that he has a gifted student who can write a poem that's worthy of being published, but you know, what's the map that they're wanting to be on? What's the city on the map, rather? Not the map that they have, you know, a problem being on, but what city on the map are they? If you think about it in the Pilgrim's Progress, what city along the journey would they rather have that poem published in?
Right. What's the last bit of that chapter? The But Prescott, like all the great idiots of history, was always willing to burn the world for a toy, a prayer, a cross, a thimble.
Yeah.
Is it a toy, a prayer, a cross, a thimble? Is that an allusion or a reference to something like that? Yes, list?
It probably is. And it's a direct parallel to the four things he has on his desk in his study that are all made of gold or brass, where he has a fish, a crucifix, a miniature of Trinity Church in Boston, and a mitre. And it's almost as if Jules reduces the faith or the world of Prescott to these little trinkets. Mm. And it's also something about Brian as well, where at one point he says, I would rather have the relic than the saint. Mm-hmm. That there's always a danger of things being diminished to the material world and then losing their true significance, because to a non-believer, faith looks like magic, and these are talismen. These are little talismanic trinkets. So it's also the same as a bit later where Jules says, I saw you weren't God. I saw you don't even believe in God, even in yourself as God. I saw you were only a cardboard dragon.
I did get curious about the thimble thing, and apparently thimbles throughout history are something you give to someone for good luck.
So there's a talisman type connection to it.
And they're kind of like, and then there's also the practical, like to avoid getting hurt. There's a practical tool that you give it, but then there's somehow along throughout history, they became something that you gave to people who were going on journeys and things like that even. And oftentimes, if you Google it, I kept seeing a lot of references to thimbles that had crosses etched on them, carved on them, painted on them, things like that. So in some ways, a toy, a prayer, a cross, a thimble could all be things you give to somebody as well for various, based on, you know, you could say for good luck in a sense, for good fortune, for goodwill, things like that.
Huh. What's so interesting is that back when Prescott was at Oxford, the thing he says is, I can't stand miracles. And yet now he keeps being mistaken for some sort of magician. And Cordelia actually calls him a magician. And he's compared, it kept sort of smacking me in the face throughout these chapters, the number of times he's compared to some sort of artifice, theatrical artifice. Vaudeville, Iago, Tamburlaine. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Again and again, he's a puppet master.
But the irony is he's not.
He's not. This is the problem with the materialistic or the materialist's view of Prescott, is that he looks like a fake.
The funny thing about these chapters where he calls him a puppet master is then you then get David Griscom, who really is the puppet master of Jules' life. He gets him into Harvard. You know, he thinks he can control the whole situation.
Oh, right.
He tells him, this is exactly what you're going to do. You're going to do what I say. You're not going to go to Europe. You're not going to figure yourself out. You're going to do exactly what I say, and I'm going to make it all work. It's almost, you know, it's a more, you know, perhaps a more affectionate, well, although is it really, way to deal with his son than what Frank does. But he's way more of a puppet master than Frank ever, because Frank allows those four boys to decide their own fate. Mm-hmm. You know, they just don't believe him. They don't believe that he says that he's going to do what he says.
That's right. He's
left the choices, and maybe the choice that he gives them is harsh. Like you could debate that. Yeah. And maybe he should have shown them mercy, but he does tell them what he's going to do. Mm. And they say, oh, he's bluffing, right?
Yeah.
They think they're going to be more clever than he is. And he just says, I told you what I was going to do. I was telling the truth.
And even afterwards, Jules says, and then I decided to be diplomatic for once. And I went and I told him that I was sorry for what I did.
Yeah.
And that I understood the punishment, but I hoped that he wouldn't extend it to the other boys.
Yeah.
And then Frank's like, no, that's not how things work.
I told you the
that's
truth.
That's not how things work. Yeah. You can't isolate yourself like that.
Yeah.
The other paradox is that for all the comparisons made between Prescott and his kind of theatrical control of things, his own image or other people, Prescott himself feels that he is the dancing bear or the clown. Mm. In the spotlight, and that he also is controlled by Griscom. So,
even his successor was chosen by Griscom, according to the daughter, right? That even that Griscom's daughter says that her daddy even found Duncan Moore to be the replacement.
The Chesterton short story that features so broadly in Brideshead Revisited, A Twitch Upon the Thread, seems quite appropriate here as well. That Charlie sees Prescott as the kind of master of the hounds, who with a touch of his finger can make the heckles on the back of his neck go down. And it's the same confusion all the time as who's pulling the threat. Is it God or is it Prescott?
And he calls him, as you've mentioned, he said it's a tough job for a boy to deal with a diplomat and a general at the same time. Like the general who just moves the troops around on the board, but also the diplomat who has to deal with the consequences of those actions. You know, he's dealing with individual people in smoky rooms, but also he's moving troops around, you know, like someone who's playing Risk. So he's to deal with the individuals and the sort of big picture movements of people. And I think that in some ways he means that in sort of a sort of insulting way, but it's also sort of a compliment to Prescott's skills as a headmaster, because a headmaster, you know, as you said, it must be a difficult job. You have to be the general and the diplomat at the same time.
Yeah.
And those are two very different skill sets. And it doesn't mean that he's not flawed. He admits it by himself, or he admits it himself, as you said, which is why he wants Jules' story included in his hagiography. All right, final thoughts. We should wrap it up. Matt, you want to go first? Got anything? What are you looking for as we're going to be reading to the end of the book, this next section. So what should people look for? What are you looking for? Or do you want to add anything that we didn't talk about?
I'm hoping to find something redemptive in the story of Jules. And then I expect that Jules' father, David, will erect a bronze statue of Frank at Justin Martyr and then make people bow down to it just to Sarah Jane's head.
Well, Sarah Jane, what about you?
I think we need to pick up the bird motif again. We find out that Griscom is a spotter. Griscom has no appreciation of nature, Jules says, and yet he keeps a list of birds. And at
the end, the section ended with
the end of the chapter.
Yes, I totally missed that again.
Yeah.
Man, I've even been looking for the bird thing since you said it.
I should have brought my field glasses. I could swear that was a great northern shrike, he says.
Yes, exactly. And earlier he paused to identify a bird. And once he expressed surprise at seeing a chewing so early in the season, there are also lots of references to geese.
Who fly in order, by the way.
I'm so bad at finding birds.
You're not a very good bird watcher.
What do birds represent? Do they represent the Holy Spirit? Do they represent some kind of spirituality that is kind of there behind the text somewhere? I don't know. I think it's interesting that Griscom is a spotter. He doesn't love nature. He just keeps a list.
Like me, I just keep lists of the books that I read and just so I can add the next book onto the list. I don't actually care about the books. I just want to be a person who keeps long lists of books that I read.
I actually think that Auchincloss is doing something clever with the bird imagery and that we might see it come to a kind of head later, because I'm sure there's another reference to Macbeth. And obviously bird imagery is really powerful in Macbeth.
We'll have to have you take us through that then when we get to the end of the book.
I think there's something there in that.
Well, we'd like 3,000 words for next week then.
We should do a crossover episode with the Plays a Thing and Close Reads, where we bring Macbeth and Rector of Justin and birds into...
That'll just be next week, I think. That's why Sarah Jane's here, right?
There are so many references to Shakespeare in here though, aren't there?
A lot, yeah.
Yeah.
I like when Cordelia says, and then my other sister, we call her Goneril.
Yes.
Yeah, that's very kind of her.
And then the hilarious thing is that the biggest owner of original manuscripts of Elizabethan plays is Griscom, who, again, he's a spotter. He keeps a list of them. He doesn't really have any appreciation of what they contain. It's all about the material for him.
We can talk about that next time. We should probably wrap this up, but
yeah.
Remember everyone, you can send in questions, podcast@gmail.com or join the Facebook group, and you can put your question there on that thread. We'll open that thread up here soon. And then on Instagram and Twitter, you can follow us at Close Reads Pods. I guess that's it. We'll finish the book for next week. Don't forget about the plays, the thing. Heidi and Tim are talking about The Tempest right now. And I believe the first three acts of that are up. Maybe the fourth act by the time this episode goes live. So be sure to check out those conversations if you love The Tempest, or if you don't, then you probably should. So you might as well listen and learn to love it. Anything else? Is that it? I think we're good. Final chapters next week. Q&A after that. I think that covers all the business.
Let's do it.
Sarah Jane, Matt, thanks for joining me.
Thanks.
Yeah, it was great to chat as ever. Speak to you next week.
Yeah, sounds good. All right. Well, for Sarah Jane and for Matt, I'm David Kern. Thanks for listening. Talk to you next week. And in the meantime, happy reading.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
it. Coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.